This morning, we are going to be looking at the resurrection text from Luke. We're kind of doing this under the rubric, It Seems Still to Be an Idle Tale, which obviously is a little bit of a play on the conclusion of the text in terms of the way the women's words were accepted. Before I get into that, I'd like to suggest a way that you might help your people kind of get into the mood of Christmas, I mean of Easter. We're going to be in good shape today, aren't we? To get into the mood for Easter, it's I think it's in Lake Wobegon days. Garrison Keillor tells about a young priest who came to be an associate to Father Emil, and he was kind of a modern priest, and gave Father Emil a lot of heartburn. And kind of the straw that broke the camel's back was that on Easter at the sunrise service, he showed up with a t-shirt that had a picture of Jesus on water skis. And underneath it, the banner, "He's up!" The last they heard of him, he was the chaplain at the amusement park at Excelsior. Okay. In looking at this text in terms of the themes from Luke that serve as a background, what I want to suggest is that part of this comes for Luke to be an answer to the question. I better turn on Iverson. The background for this and the broad background for Luke, among other things, helps to deal with the question about how Jesus, Messiah, is how he reigns. And we talked a lot yesterday in terms of on the cross, we see Jesus doing these kingly kind of things. I just turned it on, Iverson. So you missed the joke, but you can pick that up later. So what I want to do is to look at a lot of chapter 24, because I think that Luke's interpretive principle is at work there. He kind of is giving his interpretation about how this is all going to happen, and then I'm going to make some suggestions about how in the book of Acts that material demonstrated. The other thing that I want to spend a major amount of time on, as I've indicated in the second two points of the paper that I handed out, I ask a question and then I give an answer to that. I said, is the Easter proclamation difficult to hear in our day? And I think that's a rhetorical question that demands a yes answer. And I'm going to rely heavily on the insights of a book that I come back to again and again for resurrection kinds of proclamation. And it's one by an English person by the name of H.A. Williams, entitled True Resurrection. And when we get down to there, I want to just share roughly the first page of that from my memory, how he gets into, I think it's a marvelous kind of thing that you can use once in your parish on Easter, and then after that you got to think of something else to do. Or change parish. See, I get to use it now right away this year. So. Okay, let's look at the text that I've just put in juxtaposition for this morning. We could have looked at Psalm 118, that would have been very profitable, but we have selected down just a couple in order to be conserving of some time. So if someone would read for us, please, 1 Corinthians 15, 1-11, and then we'll look at the gospel text itself.
Now I would remind you, brethren, in what terms I preach to you the gospel which you received, in which you stand, by which you are saved, if you hold it fast, unless you believed in vain. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. For I am the least of the apostles, unfit to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace toward me was not in vain. On the contrary, I worked harder than any of them, though it was not I, but the grace of God which is with me. Whether then it was I or they, so we preach, and so you believe.
Okay, and then let's just look at the gospel text, and then we'll talk about these two just briefly, and then get into the background. So Luke 24, 1 to 11.
But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices which they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their heads to the ground, the men said to them, Why do you seek the living among the dead? Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and women and be crucified, and on the third day rise. And they remembered his words, and returning from the tomb, they told all this to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them who told this to the apostles. But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them.
Okay. Just any comments or observations as we, you know, think about those two texts? Talking to one another, or sitting over against one another. What comments or? Okay, that's something that again a seventh grader equipped with the two techs sitting right there would say, hey.
I made it through seventh grade.
Yeah. No, but, well, nobody else said anything, right? But what I'm saying by that is that's just so obvious. And for so long, nobody ever raised the question. But beyond that, try to get these resurrection appearances to square, the ones that Paul says happened, try to get them to square with any of the gospel texts. And so there's some other traditions going on here.
He's writing this before any of the Gospels were, you know.
So they should have taken a cue from that or something. I mean, so there's interesting questions to be raised here. The most obvious one is, I mean, here all the resurrection appearances, Mary Magdalene is included in all four of the Gospel ones, the only person that is. And that isn't even mentioned in this Pauline stuff. That raises all kinds of questions. There's a really fine book that deals with what the tradition that Paul is using, and then moves into bringing those into conversation with the gospel resurrection appearances, is a book by Reginald Fuller, entitled The Formation of the Resurrection Narratives. Are you familiar with that? I think that's really an excellent book. I had the privilege when I was in D.C. to take a course from Reginald Fuller in the Lord's Supper in the New Testament, which was a fascinating experience. He lived in Alexandria. He taught at the Episcopal Seminary there. He had a dog whose name was Philo. Philo of Alexandria. He was an Englishman. I mean, what can you, subtle humor.
The dog
too, probably. English setter, I don't know. I saw the dog, but I can't remember what it looks like. Okay. What I'd like to do is to look a moment or two at chapter 24 and point out a couple of things. And we're not going to spend time doing a comparison with the other Gospels very much, except that it's significant, and I want to come back and play on this for some preaching values. But the question that is asked is different. The statement that's made is different than you have in Matthew and Mark. The question that the men or whoever it is in the tomb ask: why do you seek the living among the dead? Now, I want to have you keep in mind for a little bit. It's not you seek Jesus of Nazareth. That's not the question that is asked here, but rather, why do you seek the living among the dead? And then the remembrance that is called to mind in the other two synoptics is, remember that he told you he was going to Galilee before you, and there you will see him. And here, that's not the way that the language goes. And instead, we have almost an exact replication of the passion prediction. And this becomes, if like in the margins of my little Bible here, in order to keep it in my memory, I put a cross every time in chapter 24 we get a mention of the cross, because that becomes a repetitious theme in 24. And we meet it first here in verse 6. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful people and be crucified and on the third day rise. And they remembered these words. The women did. And so this is another clue now that's going to be a repeating theme in this 24th chapter of Luke, is remember these words. Now, I had indicated earlier, and this is another little digression, Mary is the ideal disciple for Luke. And right away in chapter 2, she keeps these things in her heart and ponders them. And then at the end, that's in the beginning of chapter 2, after the shepherds leave, and then at the end of chapter 2, after the episode in the temple, she keeps these things in her heart. So she kind of keeps the word, and that gets to be a kind of a clue about what faithfulness is. Now when you go to the next story, which is the Emmaus text, and unfortunately it gets regulated to Easter night, and I don't know very many of us who have Easter evening services. We probably ought to, just to have these texts, because unfortunately we jump immediately in our lectionary and start dealing with John's gospel, which is fine, but it would be nice to finish out Luke's. When we meet at the beginning of this story, the same kind of theme that we had that we saw when we looked at the Transfiguration text. That following the Transfiguration text, we had this statement that they weren't able to understand these words because it was hidden from them, and the same theme comes out as Cleopas and the other disciple here walk along, and Jesus comes up, and then we see in verse 16, their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And then they repeat in their own, this is real interesting, they repeat what happens to Jesus, beginning in the last part of verse 19, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. So they've used the same language, repeated the same set of evidence that the women have gotten through the witness of these men in the tomb, but they can't see it. And remember, we talked about this earlier this week. Perhaps verse 24 is the key about why they can't understand it. We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. And their understanding, perhaps, of what it means to redeem Israel is what kept them from that understanding. And again, to repeat, part of what Luke is trying to do is to give us a new interpretation about what it means to redeem Israel. And we'll come back to that theme in a minute, I think, and show you how Luke has done some work in this. David Teede's book that I mentioned really has a good section on this whole kind of thing that Luke is trying to do, and I really commend that to you. It's not easy reading at all, but it's worth the effort. Okay, then as we get toward the end of that story, or the end of the first portion of the story, the actually being on the road in verse 24, some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, even though it seemed to them an idle tale. But him they did not see. And he said to them, "O foolish folks, slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?" Cross again. "And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself." And then, of course, Jesus fakes them out. And he makes a move like he's going to go on, and they constrain him, interestingly. And maybe in the practice of hospitality, we have some kind of shades of Genesis 18, and when God visits Abraham and so on. And in the practice of hospitality, which should say something about the Eucharist, as we pick up here in verse 30, "When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them, and their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he vanished." And then they begin to do some reflecting, and in the reflecting they realize that their hearts burned while he was talking to them about the scriptures. So in a sense, I think Luke is giving us the clue about how Jesus is to be present, one of the ways Jesus is to be present among his people, and that is in the Word and in the sacrament, in the breaking of bread together. And of course, we're going to see at the end of this story, they go and they tell what had happened on the road, and I think we need to put as much emphasis on what had happened on the road, namely the opening up of the scriptures, as well as the fact that he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. How is Jesus present in his absence, I think could be the theme of the book of Acts. And one of the answers to that is that he is present in the meal. We're going to see some other ways he's present suggested in this 24th chapter. And then lo and behold, Jesus himself stands among them. Now, I'm not going to go into this passage in a great deal, but maybe you will want to read, kind of follow along in verse 36 through 43, while I read to you a passage from the book of Tobit. Ever mess around any in the Apocrypha? Listen to this. "They were both alarmed, and they fell upon their faces, for they were afraid. And he said to them, 'Do not be afraid, you will be safe, but praise God forever. For I did not come as a favor on my part, but by the will of our God. Therefore, praise him forever. All these days I merely appeared to you and did not eat or drink, but you were seeing a vision. And now give thanks to God, for I am ascending to him who sent me. Write in a book everything that has happened.' And they stood up, but they saw him no more. So they confessed the great and wonderful works of God and acknowledged that the angel of the Lord had appeared to them." I think it's important to know the tremendous amount of intertestamental period literature and tradition that's in the New Testament. And this is just one example of that. We're going to see, or we could see some others. It's like I didn't bring up yesterday, but when John Wayne says, "Certainly this was an innocent man," that's probably an allusion to the wisdom of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 16, which it says, "The death of the righteous man condemns the ungodly who are living." So there's a, you know, there's interesting play on that. But anyway, then let's go on. Then he said to them, "These are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms," now we've added the Psalms, "must be fulfilled." And again, we've seen how much Psalm 22 gets played out, and we looked at Psalm 31 and 91, and if we, if you want to, for Easter Day, mess around a lot in Psalm 118. Then he opened their minds. Now here you have the reversal of what we had in chapter 9, right? It was hidden from them. It's also a reversal. We saw at the beginning of the reversal in the Emmaus story. He opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, "Thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sin should be preached in his name to all nations." How is Jesus present? Here are two more clues. In this preaching of the forgiveness of sins. And so again, look at the speeches in Acts and all of that kind of thing, and you will get this sense of the of where Jesus is present. And beginning from Jerusalem. And here is a suggestion, perhaps, about this reinterpretation, if that's the right word, that we've been suggesting that Luke is asking us to do about the Old Testament. In Isaiah 49, verse 6, God says, "Is it too light a thing that you should be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel? I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." And I think Luke sees the events of the crucifixion of Jesus, the destruction of Israel, as that which forced the church to the ends of the earth. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. And I have a screwball interpretation of some things in Acts that I just want to lay out for you in a minute. "And you are witnesses of these things." And then we have the, you know, the thing that's, we have an ascension, and then we have another ascension when we begin the book of Acts. I have a theory that church fights in the book of Acts are something you want to keep your eye on. And we go around wringing our hands. Ain't it awful that we have church fights? And I think Luke says, well, not necessarily. I mean, take for instance the church fight that we have in the Jerusalem Council in chapter 15. By that struggle, in which Luke kind of tends to tone it down a little bit from at least what Paul thought was going on there, where he put his fist under Peter's nose and, you know, said, "You're wrong, man." But the church fight and the result of it, maybe not the resolution of it, but the result of it was that Paul is sent out to do Gentile mission work. And then if you trace the Gentile mission work, Paul was a little hard to get along with. And so at the end, you know, John Mark takes off with him on the first missionary journey and decides that he's going home to mama or whatever. And so they get back and they're going to have a second missionary journey, and they have a big fight, Paul and Barnabas do. And so what happens as a result of that fight? You have two missionary journeys. You have the one that Paul and Silas take off on, and one that Barnabas and Mark, about which Luke is not interested. But you do have, they take off and have another missionary journey. So there really are not four missionary journeys in Acts, there are five. One of which we don't, or, and maybe many more. So that one of the things I think that's happening in all of this is this kind of working out that salvation is going out from Jerusalem and Judea to Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth, by devices they never had in mind. That's a kind of, you know, you can take that with a grain of salt, I think. But anyway, what Luke has done in this is is to help us to understand how Jesus is present in his absence. And the image that I like to use for this is part of the question is they had this feeling, this sense that after Jesus' death, he could be with the church in Jerusalem and the church in Antioch and with Paul and Deborah and Lystra and Iconium and Athens and wherever. How do you explain that? That when he was here before the cross and resurrection, if we were in Nazareth, we were stuck in Nazareth and he with us. But now he's present, more in his absence than he was in his presence. And finally, the way he is most present, of course, is in the gift of the Holy Spirit. And that, you know, you can play with some more on that. But I think that's part of what Luke is working at. Now, in terms to get at preaching values, so that you have a chance to do some talking, I'll stop for a minute and ask if anybody has any observations or questions. And
I was just curious about that reference to the swaddling in Acts and the good result of it, and the potential parallel to the Reformation age and all that's come of that. And are you comfortable with seeing the positives?
Yeah, I really am. I had this saint in my life who was a Roman Catholic priest in Virginia, in Fairfax, when I was there. His name was Paul Cowie. He had a vision for what reunited church might look like. He said, "I would love to see the Church of Jesus Christ according to the Lutheran order, and according to the Roman order, and according to the United Church of Christ order, and the Baptist order," because he said, "It is not possible for one tradition to encompass the needs of all people." And so a kind of a head person like I am, I just would go bananas in a Pentecostal tradition. But we'd better hope, like everything, that God is present in the Pentecostal tradition, because it's exploding Christianity in the third world. And, you know, there's a lot of negatives with that, because we spend, you know, another image I use, the world is burning down and we throw water on one another. This is amazing. I mean, you know, if we have three children and one of them apostates from the faith altogether and one of them becomes a fundamentalist Christian and, you know, the other one is just kind of around, who are we most concerned about? Because the one who's a fundamentalist Christian is I don't have any of those kind, but I got some of the others. But the point of it is that you know, we see that as a judgment on our house more than if they leave the faith or something. And so I think we need to reassess. Ernst Käsemann, in that book Jesus Means Freedom that I mentioned to you, has a beautiful line in which he says, you know, what would it mean for our solidarity with one another if we started with what God has given the other person that we have not received, rather than us to judge that person for what God has not given them by our lights. And, you know, that might start a different way of looking at different folks. Some of you, I've talked about this with you in other kinds of occasions. I've been helped to some, and maybe some heresy, on the whole understanding of faith development in the adult life cycle, and I think that different denominations serve different faith needs, and so that I'd better learn how to affirm people whose faith and everything and expression of it is so simplistic that it provides entry level for people that I can't touch. And maybe I ought to rejoice when some of the folks who can't get fed because I feed them something indigestible that's, you know, they can't digest, and they can go someplace else and digest it. I think, you know, but that's maybe not what Luke had in mind, but I'm pretty convinced that we need to rethink a lot of this stuff. And then, of course, I know we had a discussion and somebody mentioned to me, well, they won't return the favor. Well, so what? That may be part of the cross that we bear in love. And if we can do that without being arrogant, well, look how much better I am because I can bear with you and you don't bear with me. Now, the other thing I need to say, I talk a heck of a lot better game than I play. So, the next thing I do want to look for a minute at and suggest some things. I believe that for most of our people, Easter is wishful thinking. And this in this book by H.A. Williams, it's worth the price of the book for the sermon that you can begin with by reading the first page. And he talks about what a glorious day Easter is in our churches, filled with flowers and the loveliness and the fragrance of them all, with triumphant music accompanied with trumpets and organ at full, you know, with all the stops out. And it is a marvelous experience while it lasts. He says for some it may last for quite a while. And for some not so long. And for some never at all. And they come and they stand really as outsiders because they don't have any paradigms, any analogs, any places where resurrection connects with their life. And then he starts in this book to begin to help us to understand that if we begin to look at our own stories, that we do have, all of us, little resurrections in our lives. And one of the images that he uses that I love, I just love to play with this phrase, he says that what we have is that most of us have an undead past. Hear that? The undead past. We think that it's dead and past, right? Oh, no. Yeah, we wish, huh? And that undead past enslaves us. People who are the adult children of alcoholics, you know, just to start listing that kind of thing, or those of us who are captive by our own behaviors and attitudes, that's part of the undead past that we carry. And then he looks, and I'll just suggest a few of these things because I want to get you to start thinking about some of your resurrection stories and some that we can help one another with some preaching on. He uses one illustration that's available to all of us, and that is someone who has been chemically dependent, who becomes free of that, and they kind of live a new life. I remember I got this book I think November of 1972, and I read it, and I don't know what in the world the sermon was about, but of course I'd read this book, so I whipped that bugger in there. And I used this story about, you know, somebody, the resurrection sense of somebody who's been captive to alcohol, and a family that we had been particularly close to about 6 months later left the congregation and moved to Florida. And we, you know, we were often over there, and always Ray served alcohol. And as observant as I was, I never noticed that Becky never drank. I mean, there were a lot of booze flowed, believe me. So I went over there to say goodbye to them, and she said, "Charlie, I'd like to talk to you for a minute." And so we went off in another room, and she said, "You know, several months ago you told, you talked about new life and that comes when somebody is free, finally gets free from alcohol dependency." She said, "I know exactly what you're talking about because I'm an alcoholic." And then another illustration that he uses a story of a couple, a married couple, who through the course of years, the sands of time and kind of the eroding winds of not really paying much attention to one another take their toll. And they just kind of slowly drift apart, and the love and all that they once had just kind of dies. And then through whatever kinds of events, I don't know what particulars he gives of that, they begin to get it back together again. That's another little glimpse of resurrection. And then he has a chapter on resurrection and suffering. And the image he uses here, and I don't remember the statue, but it's It's evidently quite a famous statue that's at the Louvre or some gallery in Europe. That is, there are four figures in this statue, and the way the artist has carved them is that at the base you can see the rock itself, and then you can see the hammer marks, the chisels, it's rough, and then it slowly moves into being smooth. And he says that his understanding of life is that God works our lives into, you know, to what they are, not in spite of the hammer blows that come to us, but precisely because of them. And so again, another way to look at some of the pain and some of the suffering that has the deadly potential of killing us long before we die, but also through some kind of act of grace often has the potential to bring us depth and stature and a humanity that lets us be sensitive and caring that we would never have without having experienced that pain. And I think if we can begin to lift up some of those very mundane kinds of things in our Easter proclamation, that we will give people something that lasts because it weds the word with them, and it brings in what Luke is talking about in terms of the Christ and of the cross and maybe not the necessity, but certainly the reality that it's going to be in all of our lives. And so you know, if people had watched my preaching schedule, I was probably the only senior pastor in Minneapolis whose associates preached on the high festivals fairly often. And people thought, boy, Charlie is really humble and generous and all that. He just hated to preach on Easter and Christmas, that's all. And the reason for that is that I've always been, you know, I've always felt the inadequacy of preaching in the midst of the great expectations. And you blow out all the trumpets and get all the lilies out there, and then you get up there with these feeble words. But maybe that's the clue to the whole thing, is that in the midst of that kind of feeble struggling, the folks can have something to grab a hold of, and they can then not have to go and seek the living among the dead, because that's what, you know, we want to do in our religious experiences. We want to go back to those, and they've died. And this, the problem with Jesus, he's always, you know, out there in the midst of where we are, and to try to go back to where we first found him, or he found us, or where we think maybe even the Bible tells us he's to be found. I think Luke says, well, read it again and see if he's not to be found someplace else. Okay, enough of that, of my preaching and that kind of thing. I'd just like to have us share now some, you know, as I suggest in this thing, that maybe stories from life can be in modern paradigms for use in the resurrection proclamation, so that we don't go back there to where it's dead.
I just came across a little story before I came up here that might just kind of introduce that whole kind of thing about many years ago. There's an evil king that had all power, and he could do whatever to his people, but he couldn't get them to lose their belief in God. And so he called his three wisest counselors, and the first one said, well, why don't we put God up beyond the stars, and they will never find him up there. And the other one said, oh, that's dumb. Someday they may be able to fly beyond the stars and they will find him there. And so the second one said, well, maybe we can put him deep in the ocean and hide him there. And the other says, no, someday they may be able to go down deep into the ocean and find them. And the other one said, I know, let's hide them in the ordinary life of people. I don't know. It's kind of a haunting story, the same kind of thing.
Okay. Good.
I had experienced something like your business with the alcohol, and attended a workshop led by Maria Fortune on sexual violence and sexual abuse. And she gave forth the statistics, which are apparently verified, that a great proportion of our people have had some kinds of physical or sexual abuse, and they're growing and are living in it, and even while they're there with us in the church. She said, mention that you've been to a workshop like this. Write about it in the newsletter. Illustrate something in the sermon. She says, you will give those people permission to speak, the undead life, let it out. I did that, and it was just an instant kind of thing where two or three people then came to me privately and said, this is part of what I carry.
There's another book I would recommend to you. I don't know how easy it is to get. It's written by a woman who lives in Port Angeles. Her husband is the director of the national park, Olympic National Park. It is just an incredible book called Whiskey's Song. She is an adult child of an alcoholic. Both her parents were alcoholic. And last year, Passion Sunday, I had one of my 3-minute sermons. And one of the little snippets I used was one of her pieces out of that called Nobody Can Hurt You Like Mama Can. And I mean, you want to talk about being on the cross. There's that sense, but there's also this kind of strength of humanity, or whatever is the right phrase for that, about the rescue from that, the newness after that. Betsy Chandler is her, or Mitzi, Betsy Chandler is her last name anyway. Whiskey's Song. It's just, for people who've been in that experience, some people can't take it. I mean, but it does begin to give them some freedom from the undead past. And when I shared that, again, the same experience. I think everybody that's out there in our congregation, I shared, the sense of our son coming home. That's a resurrection kind of thing. And some of it, obviously, is you can't. That's way too close because of its infringement on him. But in fact, it's real interesting. When I left my second parish, they said, I think we're going to have to send one of us along to listen to your sermons in Minneapolis, because you always talked about those folks in your former parish.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I've always moved at least a half a continent at a time.
And somehow, if you don't declare that this is a story from way some other place, they're all thinking the rest of the sermon.
Yeah.
Which one is he talking about here? And you've lost them.
Well, the similar vein stories, like stories of ACOA or stories of sexual or physical abuse, being with someone who is severely depressed and working through some mental health issues, I think it's crucial. And talking about mental hospitals and talking about what happens.
Mm-hmm.
How folk have grown.
Yeah.
Again, you mentioned that, and people start dropping by your office with their stories.
And it's amazing, if you want to use the empty tomb analogy and that kind of thing, why do you seek the living among the dead? You've got to go back to that tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to hear some things again. Remember how he said to you. So there's lots of things to play with in these texts that require a little imagination. And I also think that one of the nice things about preaching on the festivals is everything else is going on, so they can be short sermons. You don't talk it to death.
We have a young gal that's pretty sharp in our parish, but was raised under a kind of a very rigid view of the scriptures.
and where it was more, you know, sort of, that's it, you better believe it kind of emphasis. And she finally picked up on one of my favorite themes, that the scriptures are witness as well as record of fact. And she talks about how freeing that's been for her from a perspective of both reading the scriptures and also her own personal faith. It was, ended up affirming the validity of her faith, which the old view of the scriptures ended up denying it.
One of the things that hearing what you said too is I'm wondering, you know, resurrection, does hope give meaning to a person's life? Or does meaning, you know, as to what the scriptures mean, give hope? Which is the chicken, which is the egg? You know, what did it for those people who heard the story and do hear the story? Does the meaning give hope? Does the hope give meaning?
That's something that I suppose each instance dictates where that comes from. See, I've played around a long time with trying to figure out the difference between faith and hope. And where I am at this point in time, and I should have told you at the very first that whatever I say, don't hold me to, because I probably changed my mind in 2 weeks. So, I mean, this is just kind of a report along the way. But, see, I'm not too sure that people in our situation can hope. It seems to me that we have, you know, we're in a faith that we've been given so much, and we're kind of in what's there to hope for? And it seems to me that hope begins when faith is exhausted. And I have a lot of theories. One of which, there are a lot of passages in Scripture that we talked a little bit about this yesterday, that I can't use the personal pronoun with. And one of them is the passage when we were doing the text study yesterday, and you get into 2 Corinthians 4:7, you know, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, and then Paul goes on to delineate all that's happened to him. Well, I've had a few things that, you know, that were testing perhaps. But my life has been exceptionally blessed, and so for me to go to somebody and say, "Oh, I know just how you feel and all that," so what I have to do as a proclaimer is then I have to tell other people's stories and be real careful to listen to people who, in the midst of situations that I would judge to be utter disasters, are able to speak a word of hope. You know, or who's speaking gives hope to others. So, because sometimes we pastors simply ought to go under the name Job's Friends, and then we'd have some truth in advertising. We have Deuteronomic theologies, and we go give it to everybody, and then we need to hear the word at the end of Job, which says, you know, you have spoken to me that which is true, but your friends haven't. And all Job said is, why don't you say something once? But anyway.
It may not be that, at least some of us can find an occasional empty tomb in our life, but there are a lot of them that are still filled. Those tombs are really still filled. They haven't been emptied yet.
Right.
I mean, there's tomb and there are tombs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And doesn't that, that is that's the norm. That's what you'd expect. The whole thing in finding an empty one is the fact that it's not
expectation. I mean, there's always a surprise there.
That's
right. That's why it's always gift.
Yeah.
It's always gift. It's not, we expect Easter. Nobody expects it, Easter, you know. It's in the midst of the hopelessness of seeing the darkness, and it doesn't look like there's any light at the end of the tunnel, that when that light comes, where did that come?
No, and I don't have an Easter story to tell about in this case, but I just want to give you a pastoral situation. When I was still in Renton, one of our members found a little work for me to do. I have no idea how this woman found this other woman who lived down in a trailer court. And she was had been raised on the Swedish side of Paulsbo as a Lutheran. And when she was older, I don't know how old, I suppose in her 50s or whatever, she and her husband were in a terrible accident. And the accident left her with very poor circulation in her legs. And as she got even older, that became an excruciatingly painful situation. And it's here that I enter the story. And so this woman says, you ought to go see this woman. So I went to see her, and I visited her regularly over a long period of time until I left Renton. And she would sit there confined in her great pain watching the PTL club and listening to these people who had gotten the faith and who had prayed to Jesus, and they'd been miraculously healed and all kinds of things. And so she kind of worked that side of the street as best she could and didn't work. And so then she got out her Bible. I mean, she literally went through she read the whole Bible and underlined every promise, every one of them, where God said that, you know, if you'll just, I mean, I suppose even some of the Psalms we looked at. And it still didn't work. So she was in this dilemma. And this is the dilemma. Either something is wrong with me, or something is wrong with God. And the kind of piety that she had would not permit the second option. So all of this kind of hope, and we have to speak words of hope, right? I mean, became then judgment. Judgment. And I, you know, I wondered if my kind of, well, God is with you in your pain. I mean, does that help? Do you hear Jesus praying with you? My God, why have you forsaken me? I don't know whether that, you know, but that's kind of the weakness of the message that we proclaim, and somehow, you know, to be with her and all that. But what, you know, the other part of it, and this I, you know, I want to raise the other issue about this, about why we expect God to help. I know Carol's going to have a discussion tonight on Douglas John Hall's book, God and Human Suffering, which is a book I commend to you. But, you know, one of the things that Doug says in there is you're just going to suffer sometimes. It's just not part of the human. It doesn't have any meaning. But I think that at least the subject that I most enjoy talking about, because I don't have any idea where it resolves, I did a tape on it up here a couple of years ago on fertility, religion, and biblical faith. I believe that all of us are about the business of fertility religion. You know, by fertility religion, I don't mean the sexual part of it, but what fertility religion is about, as I understand it, is to try to make the world come out right. So that if I practice certain things, my garden will grow and I'll drive a Cadillac or Mercedes or whatever. That's the grossest kind of thing. Or I'll get parking places or whatever. But my wife gets sick, and so I start to pray like mad. And am I then in the fertility business, religion business? Where do we draw the line between... I think there's a continuum between praying for parking places and praying for health. Where is it ridiculous, and where do you cross that line? As I mentioned earlier, from a remark that Marty made, I heard him make the University of Minnesota Hospital thing one day, he said, you know, if a person is a Lutheran and they're suffering, you just help them find some meaning in that, and you got it made, Pastor. And so for us, I think in our tradition, and maybe for me who tends to like to think things through, that if I can figure out the meaning of it, then my world comes out right. But that's, again, fertility religion. And the deepest thing about biblical faith, I think, is the passage, again, I've shared a couple times, I'm sure, this week already, is Isaiah's image about we're the clay and God is the potter, and by God he does what he wants with us. Or she does, or whatever. I mean, that's hard stuff to swallow. And so one of the dangers, one of the real dangers of resurrection preaching, and even the examples we've given here, are it's going to turn out all right. And maybe that's why even having some secular examples of resurrection thing are important. You know, and of course part of this gets down to what our ultimate view of life is, whether we see life finally as tragic or whatever, and I do, not because my life has been, but because the life of the world is. And so, you know, I mean, that'd be a wonderful Easter sermon, right? Hey folks, you all came here looking for fertility religion, and it ain't found here. Maybe that's what I'll go with.
Talk about Easter
egg. Nice sermon, Pastor.
A couple of years ago, you used the Easter egg illustration of that the seed was not a good one, because we expect the seed to grow. Mm-hmm. We do it all, get it all in pieces, right? Plant the seed, we expect growth. What we need is something that surprises us. Mm-hmm. Goes beyond our expectations. That was very helpful for me. I just, you know, we're talking about images of my views, and one that popped into my head for the first time is, you know, what do you do with an empty tomb? You know, you can use it again. And what needs to be buried? Sure. Now that the tomb is ready.
Is there a possibility, you know, in telling all these success stories, though, that, you know, if we see ourselves as a part of community, you know, my rehearsal about this good news in another person's life becomes the source of depression in the other person's life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Sure.
And I think we need to acknowledge that. I'll tell you a story about that, an illustration of this. My first parish. See, I've got it. It's one of these I told Renton that that's why they wanted to go to Minneapolis. But we had two fellows in the congregation who got different kinds of cancer almost simultaneously, or discovered they had one. One of the guys was, he'd come from Utah, and while he was there he had married a Mormon. And I mean, this was, they'd lived there years and years and years. And so Bill and his two sons were Lutherans, and his wife and his daughter were Mormons, a convenient arrangement. And he discovered very late, far too late to do anything about that, he had liver cancer. And he discovered that in September, and he died the day after Christmas. And this other guy who was charismatic, in fact, he even took me to the National Lutheran Leaders Charismatic Conference in Ann Arbor, Michigan once. Great experience. I almost had to put a badge on me, I'm an observer, but well, that's another story. Yeah, right. I mean, because I'd run into my classmate, are you one too? No, I'm just an observer. No. But it was a great experience. But anyway, so Hendrick, what he discovered was he was an official, worked in the Department of Labor, and he often went under the auspices of the State Department to third world countries to help them develop their labor resources. And in getting a physical to go to one, they discovered that he had a cancerous nodule on his vocal cords. So I remember spending almost one whole day with him while he agonized over whether or not he ought to go see a doctor or just pray about it. And another guy in the congregation finally gave him the pastoral advice that I guess I wasn't able to, said, well, are they mutually exclusive, you know? Why don't you go to the doctor and pray about that? But so anyway, Hendrick, make a long story short, Hendrick was cured of that. And so he got up in church, he wanted to get up in church and thank the congregation for its prayers and all of this, about 2 weeks after Bill died. Now, Bill's wife had never, in all the time that he was a member of Bethlehem, ever come to church with him. And after his funeral, she came every Sunday until I left, at least. And how much longer, I don't know. So she was in church. And he gets up there and talks about how God cured him. And so I got up and said, you know, I tried to correct that theology, that, you know, we can be thankful when those things happen, but it's not a judgment when they don't. So that's a good reminder, Arlen. I appreciate that. See, there are some who want to use the analogy, and I think this is helpful. What the resurrection does is make the cross available to us. And I think that way the resurrection doesn't overcome the cross. But it puts us in touch with that. And then the thing I need to fear is that I do that intellectually. And we function very differently. So.
I told my congregation that, that I'm a recovering abuser of alcohol. And just opened the floodgates. But I had to be very careful in saying that I didn't say, hey, you know, I got this marvelous victory. Because I think it's true about everyone who's, participated in that enslavement. There's a string on you, you know? And you feel like you've, in a sense, you've left that tomb. But there's that tug that can drag you back.
The undead past, yeah.
Okay. And then, so the, I think that the good thing that happened was that I was saying, I'm a companion in struggle.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To take the language a little more, a little further maybe from that whole arena to, and the change that's come about from saying recovery to recovery, maybe a faith point of view that we all need.
And that companion talk is Luke talk in Acts about who this Jesus is. And we can be a little Christ to one another in that way, I think. Changes our resurrection preaching, I think, a lot from the kind of rehearsing of stuff that takes Jesus, I think, just out of the realm. You know, Douglas John Hall, in his book, has the Church a Future, says, you know, when we turn Jesus into a success story, even through the resurrection, we remove him from the realm of all people, for by human standards, all of us fail, because none of us get out of it alive, and that's the ultimate failure for us. But to have him be with us, victim.
Bill Stahl uses the phrase the vindication of the crucified Messiah. Mm-hmm. That puts you back.
Yeah.
I still am struggling some with one part of me, like, really believes in the power of Christ working in our middle and upper middle class lives and those sort of struggles. And then the other side of me is struggles with taking Jesus out of the realm of the historical Jesus as far as being with the poor and the afflicted, and I see myself more as a Pharisee, really, trying to think how does the resurrection work, you know, there. And so I get real torn between with that, you know, what to do with that. And it never goes away. I mean, that's the string that keeps me, you know, is really believing in the power of Christ working with us in our codependency and our alcoholism struggles and all those sort of things. But what happens with, I mean, the story really is coming out of the social political stuff around.
Two responses, just to get direction of some place to read to continue that struggle, is the last chapter in The Crucified God by Jürgen Moltmann, about, you know, when he talks about the, you know, the liberation of the oppressed will look different than the liberation of the oppressor. But I think that's a struggle that's worth it. And then the other thing, and this gets real dangerous, and I think it's one of the reasons why Matthew Fox has been so terribly popular among middle class folks, because he, you know, with the original blessing and all that, but acknowledging that there's a real danger in this, again, this little book I've been hawking by Klaus Westermann is helpful to think in terms of the blessing activity of God, and in one sense to begin that's what's happened to us, and then the question is, the old Bethel series thing is blessed to be a blessing. How do we get to the second part of that? And I think it is the struggle. And again, you know, we didn't touch at all on Luke's social gospel because it doesn't come up in Lent. But if you miss the opportunity to struggle with that in Luke, you just, you know, unless you get into James, who's such a hard pill to swallow that we never study it. You know, James is so marvelous, and you know, he said, you know, what is with you people are just crazy. He said, these rich folks come into church and you say, my, why don't you sit right up here in front? Right here where it's warm. And he says, and those are the folks that are beating your brains out as soon as they get out of church. So we don't read James much. But Luke, you know, Luke essentially talks about three things about wealth that in terms of the warning about its seductive nature, and that it will seduce us away from our dependence on God, and we are there, and then the call to well, you know, I used to think this was meant only, you know, one of the arguments is that this call to sell everything, and Luke has it in every text except, you know, when Jesus says something, you know, they left, the disciple, or Matthew left everything and followed him. He always puts in punta, except at 12:33. And it's a real puzzle to me. I mean, that's the real kicker, you know. We talked about that earlier, that fear not, little flock, for it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And then what both Matthew and Mark have, sell everything, all that you have. And Luke does not have that at that point. This is a puzzle to me. But anyway, so I always thought that belonged only to, you know, that was just for the disciples, and that was just Luke's way of putting it way out there and to call us to a middle position. But then you see, I see some folks, you know, you certainly see Mother Teresa as a famous person that does that. But I know some people in my own life who I think have pretty well done that. And so I think, well, that's, I better listen to that word. It isn't just an ideal to be striven for, but it is a reality to be lived. And then the other thing is to use the possessions that we've been given, which is very Lucan. And Zacchaeus becomes the example of that. But we need to hold that up for our people and not waver on it. We also need to hold up in stewardship for our people that stewardship isn't just what you do with what you got, it's how you get what you got. And that's why the Roman Catholic, and I haven't read it in its entirety, the Roman Catholic bishop's letter on the economy, you know, drove William Simons, a good, devout Roman Catholic, crazy. Say nothing of William Buckley, but I mean, you know, it's some sacred cows there. But good observation. I mean, and we need to struggle with that. You know, how is Jesus with us? And part of the problem when we get into these, you know, even after I've given you all these illustrations, part of them leave us pretty much as we were before in regard to that question. And also, we, in order to make the gospel relevant, or we think in order to make it relevant or relative to the lives of our people who are middle class, we get into psychological pain and relational pain, and all, which is the pain of our people. So that's valid at that point, but if we don't help them see the pain of others or whatever that we are a part of, you know. So I mean, these wonderfully clarifying things, aren't they?
Also, don't we get caught up, you know, you're talking about the kind of fertility religion syndrome, which also can take the, it almost develops a hubris about some of the pain.
You know, I was a drug addict, and that gives me, I mean, we speak about that like it was, rather than an escape from a tomb, suddenly now that gives me validity. And I remember being at a Word and Witness training seminar. We were a lot of folks kind of doing that, and one person there just saying, "Gee, I don't feel very much like a Christian. I've never been a drunk. I've never had any of these kind of things. I guess I better go find something like that so I can start to become authentic." We do that same process with poverty. I mean, we suddenly make the poor into saints, and we're called to minister to that, not necessarily, but also recognize the active evil in that lifestyle, as well as the rich and middle class. I mean, there's a brokenness in all kinds of places that have to be struggled with.
I've done a fair amount of work in what's called the third world, and known an awful lot of people who, in our terms, are poor, but they don't think of themselves as poor. They are just people living in their place and in their time and adjusting to the tensions that are part of their life. And the opposite of that is also true. I've known some fabulously wealthy people in terms of the material wealth and the widgets and so forth that aren't possessed by their wealth. They don't know that they're rich. That doesn't govern the way they interact with each other. There are other battles that make them successful or failures in their interaction that have nothing to do with their economic.
Have you found happier people than what we saw in San Jose de Bucay? I mean,
yeah, I don't want to romanticize them, that they were happy because they were poor. There were happy and miserable people there who were destined to be poor.
Well, it's our ending time, so we'll draw it to a close. I hope that in this stuff that we've gone through, that my hope that you have more questions now than when we started on Monday has been fulfilled. And then also that we have this, at least to see Luke in a new perspective and encourage you to see him in your own perspective. And because I think the author of Luke is a literary genius, if nothing else. And also to see how the this gospel is a marvelous insight into the use of the tradition of the Hebrew Bible and of the culture that it probably was born in, and that can become for us some kind of a springboard for our own imagination to take the tradition that we have and to work it and to make it our own, and then to hammer it into a different form. The trick, and I heard this last night for those of you who are here, that they were struggling with here in Holden in the community, is if you can think of the tradition as a piece of clay, it ought to be able to be formed into all kinds of shapes. But we have a hard time figuring out what's the clay and what's the essence of that. It's one of the reasons we as Lutherans, I think, we don't even know what the essence of Lutheran worship is. Or we could give it to some other tradition so that culture, so that Hispanics could have Lutheran worship. But if they can't do it Northern European, why, forget it. So So we, you know, we've got a lot of work to do to get back to the kind of originality and creativity and imagination that we find in our gospel writers.
Thank God you can't do that, or we'd really be separate.
Yeah, yeah, it's, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's all of our struggle. I mean, as you know, that, and the marvelous thing is that just when you get settled in one place, then you look back and something's coming loose, and you know, and so it's. Yeah, that's right. It's just like the Bible. When we get one issue settled, then some little old lady in tennis shoes says, "Well, Pastor, it says right here." Blows everything apart. Wonderful. Okay, thank you. It's break time.
Thank you.